What's interesting about this July 4th thing is it was the day America declared independence from England. So they always blow up all kinds of fireworks and rockets to commemorate the day, because it was also a day which initiated the Revolutionary War. And so there was a lot of fireworks going on. But what's interesting about the day today, besides the fact that there's a spectacular display that we go to every year with my parents to watch, we lay on the ground on this big field and just watch everything above, all this incredible display of fireworks, and it's really spectacular. And the thing is that every dog freaks out. They all hide. They're just freaking out completely with all this sound and all these explosions and everything. And what I find interesting is that we accept all of that as kind of pleasurable, but every dog goes insane with the sound. They even offer tranquilizers for dogs because of the horrible situation for these poor creatures. And every year when I lay there on the ground and I watch this, although the visual effect of the firework is absolutely spectacular. I mean, really spectacular. It's just, they go out of their way in Alachua to do the absolutely best show. In fact, they even advertise it as the greatest small town fireworks in America. And it might be. I mean, it's really good. But every time they blow off these big sounds and it goes boom, It just shatters me inside somehow. So this year I'm going to try to remember to bring earplugs. But even you bring earplugs, it doesn't help, because it's like a shock, a reverberation. It's something that goes deeply inside of you, and it just shakes you up inside. I remember, I think it was perhaps 1980 or 1981, I had been going to Lebanon fairly frequently. And one thing in Beirut that really amazed me was that when you travel on the streets, every building had these huge holes from bullets, because they were using these, I think, Russian, whatever they're called, rifles, and they had huge shells that were just making huge holes in all of the buildings. So you would see every building was like peppered with these automatic weapons that had made these holes. And I had thought that things were fairly peaceful, because it's people were going along their business as usual. So we would drive on the road or walk on the road. Things seemed to be over from the heavy civil war, which had been there in 76 or something like that. So I was in the apartment of a friend of mine. He was a former PLO member. So he was Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO member. He was a fairly heavy character. I mean, fairly heavy character. And so we're in his apartment. And actually, it's his parents' apartment. And we have this room that we're staying in. So I'm laying down. It's like about, I don't know, 10:30 at night, something like that. And he was just meditating. And then all of a sudden, I hear this huge boom, which was so incredibly loud, and it just hit with this shock wave and just practically shot me off the floor where I was sleeping, just shot me up in the air. And I'm in a state of complete horror, what just happened? You know, I thought maybe the building was falling down or God knows what. And he was meditating, so he just opens his eyes and he says like this, and I'm supposed to just not pay any attention to the fact that, you know, the world just caved in. So I go, but there was this huge explosion. And finally he breaks his meditation and says, don't worry about it. They just blew up the building next door. We're okay. And I just looked at him that they blew up the building next door and we're okay. So I shouldn't worry about it. And I must say, this was one of the most interesting experiences I've ever had. And because of the situation, I didn't even dare to go to the window to look at the building next door. It was only till the next day that I actually saw the building next door was in shambles. It had crumbled. I decided it was maybe better to move out of Beirut at that moment. So the next day I made plans to go. But I just remembered it from the fireworks, and I think I may be traumatized. Therefore, whenever I hear these big sounds, it really shocks me. Okay, that's enough with the stories related to July 4th. But it's actually interesting that last night we were suddenly invited to a party, because sometimes people have July 4th go outside and do things, parties. And I was speaking to one man. He's actually a researcher, quite an expert mathematician, because last night the whole party was filled with professors from the universities here. And he was talking about, he had met this person. The Germans will recognize the name, at least, Rudi Schilt. He was a professor in Massachusetts at one of the universities up there. I forgot which one. And he is one of the recognized experts in the world in black holes. And he doesn't even like to use the word black hole. He says the word black hole is a misnomer. But one of the things that we talked about, he was explaining to me that this man was saying about this dark matter, the fact that of all of the observable existence that we can see, and all of it that we can measure, it doesn't add up to the total mass that somehow or another is predictable or is something that they are able to understand to be the mass that should be there. So the physicists conclude that most of the mass, the weight of matter, the substance of matter in the universe is missing, in the sense that you can't find it, you can't figure out where it is in the calculations of the mass of the universe. So there are a lot of theories about this. Some of these theories, they're dealing with the black holes and everything, which are supposed to have enormous mass, that light is bending into them, that gravity is inverted within them, that they are absorbing matter at rapid rates. I may have mentioned it before, but I think that the Vedic literature deals with black holes as the stem of the lotus flower from Garbhadakshay Vishnu. My translator here is having a hard time with Garbhadakshay Vishnu, but anyway, those of you who know, you know. And the idea is that there is this hollow stem. And it's the black hole idea. Now they speak about black holes, that every universe has one in the center. Or not universe, or galaxy has one in the center. And that all of the galaxies, they have this central point within which, or around which, everything is moving. And somehow these black holes are related to the birth of the universe and the sustenance of it. And by the nature of black holes, the dissolution of it. Because everything ultimately will be sucked into these black holes. So I've begun to think about it in terms of the Vedic terms, that actually the black hole and the hollow lotus stem are somehow related, that there is a similarity between these two understandings. Now, when we were talking last night, he started describing what this man, Dr. Schild, was talking about in terms of dark matter. Dark matter meaning matter we do not have the senses to perceive, matter that we do not have instruments to perceive, matter which only relates to perhaps some other dimension of perception, or which is only understood by subtractive logic. That's a very easy way, an easy concept. It means there's this predictable total mass of the universe. There's the perceivable total mass of the universe. You subtract the perceived mass from the predicted mass, and you have this leftover chunk of dark matter, or matter which cannot be perceived, but which is understood by its inference. It's an inferred existence. It's inferred in the sense that you only know it by some logical reasoning, by its symptoms. Now that is a very reasonable way to understand things. For example, when we deal with people, often people do not express directly how they feel or what they're really thinking. They don't usually express it. So when they don't express it like this, we find that there is a way in which we can understand what they mean, or a way in which we can understand what they're talking about by deduction. We deduce what it is that they mean to say, or what they think, what we think they're saying, or what they really want to say but don't. We understand it by deduction, by figuring out the symptoms of the way they look, or certain things they have said, and or certain ways they have said it. And because of this, we deduce what they mean. You can also deduce how people feel about you by certain symptoms of the way they might look, or the way they might relate in certain instances. So this deductive reasoning is used by everybody all the time. It's used by police when they try to figure out a crime, because the criminals don't come up and they say, "I did it, I'm the one, and this is how I did it." Now, the reason I'm talking about this is because it is directly related to the fundamental means by which spirituality and spirit function in this world. And it is the primary means by which any mystical activity takes place. When I was talking to this man about dark matter, I concluded that it seems to me that dark matter is directly related to ether, that it is ether in the sense that ether is the fundamental element of all existence. It's the element upon which all things rest and all interactions take place. Now, if you think about that, if you accept that definition, it is the standard one, but if you think about it, it's very interesting because if you think about all this that is here, it's very heavy. Planets weigh a lot. All things are heavy. They're powerful. So if everything is resting in the ether, you would naturally assume the ether is heavier and stronger and more powerful than all those things that rest within it. From that point of view, it makes sense that the ether and dark matter, they're related because it has an enormous amount of mass. Yet, no instrument can measure the mass. No sense can perceive it. That does not mean it's not there. When you think about the way in which we experience love, even from enormous intercontinental distances, how we can contact those of us, of course, who have mystic capacity. I'm not talking about anybody. Everybody can do this. There's no doubt about it. Sometimes people have experiences of connecting to a lost, dead one, person who has died, yet they have a direct connection with them, even if only for some moments. They may cry, but then their rational mind will have them wipe away the experience. But for those of us who consciously embrace the mystical energy, for those of us who consciously utilize it, the idea of the way in which, or the media in which these kinds of mystical energies flow is not only consciously perceivable to us, but it makes perfect sense. It is part of existence. And in fact, it has density. Density. So density is a very interesting concept. I've talked about this before, but I want to use this discussion to relate it to dark matter because I think that at one point we're going to see the world of people who are totally consciously absorbed in matter connect with the mystical minded. And all of a sudden there's going to be an aha moment where people who really we would maybe label as materialistic, in other words, they're people who are not aware of certain aspects of existence, they will have an aha moment when the science connects to mysticism. You know, for years, there's always this science and religion dichotomy. And in the past, it has been a conflict. They are opposed to each other, seemingly. And the only way in which religion and science seem to connect is when religion compromises enough to accept some scientific principles, like, Darwinian principle or some kind of like intelligent design evolution or something like this. There's always some kind of compromise on the religious side to come closer to science because science is so powerful, they have to compromise with their enemy. But I don't think that's going to be the long-term methodology because after all, there's just so many compromises you can make. What I think is going to happen is that due to the fact that there is certain parts of the quantum physics realm, professors, researchers, scientists, who are starting to understand to at least some extent that this problem, as it's called, of dark matter is actually the realm and the field within which the mystical energies work and operate. Now, the mystical personalities are also not aware of how it functions, precisely, or the manner in which that functioning directly relates to the physical realm. The link is not obvious between the two. Now, hang on, let me stop there for a second, because there are some in the mystical realm who definitely understand it, who absolutely definitely understand it. You've got people like Uri Geller who look at spoons and bend them around. You've got mystics who can reach to some other part of the world and bring some grapes. I know a person who, he was an architect in London. He worked with us on the Mayapur project. He told me about, he went to Sai Baba and he brought some grapes for him. There are mystic yogis. There are people who have capacities. There's the Naga Babas who come to the Melas, like the Mahakumbha Melas every 12 years in India. I'm losing my translator with all these Sanskrit words, sorry. Anyway, it's there's a big festival every 12 years in India, Kumbha Mela. And the idea of it is that there are these Naga Babas who show up. Naga Baba, Babas, you know, they're like yogis. But these are yogis who live totally naked in the Himalayan mountains. And they live in a place which is desperately cold. And there are, of course, yogic postures which will raise your bodily temperature enormously. So they keep their bodily temperature high, and if your body temperature is high, it doesn't matter what the temperature is outside. Usually when you go outside and it's freezing cold and the cold hits you, it disturbs you because it makes a transformation physiologically which causes your temperature to be radically affected, your bodily temperature radically affected by the cold. And yet, these yogis managed to deal with that. I also saw I think he was Dutch. Maybe he was Swiss. Anyway, he was doing a test. They put him in ice cubes. And he was maintaining his body temperature in an ice cube tub for, I think it was 45 minutes or an hour. I saw it on TV. It was very interesting. But these Naga Babas, they also do something much more spectacular than just keep themselves warm. They manage to go from their Himalayan retreat to the Kumbha Mela, which is somewhere, you know, at the place where the Triveni, it's called, the three rivers, the Ganga, the Saraswati, and the Jamuna meet in India. They manage to get there. They don't take a bus. They don't have money. They don't take a plane. You're not going to see, I think it's like 30 or 40 of them, naked yogis on an airplane. Doesn't happen. They don't hitchhike. They just show up. And everybody knows it there in the middle. Everybody knows that these yogis just show up. They're not there. And then they're there. And at the end of the Kumbha Mela, they're not there. And I have seen videos of how millions of people are just in awe of these yogis. When they go to take a bath at that proper moment, that's the whole point of the Kumbha Mela, to be there at the exact moment, take a bath. Everybody gets out of the water, and we're talking about millions and millions of people. Everybody gets out of the water. The army and police make a whole passageway. All people are standing to the side. And these yogis come and walk to the water, take their bath, stay there for some time. They play around. They're a bunch of fun guys. And then they go back. And then everybody goes to the water. So we have an example of human beings who have managed to understand the interface between the mystical energy and the energy of this perceivable, manifested realm. And when this dark matter is spoken of, it's actually spoken of in real terms, because it has properties that are real, but we just can't perceive them. It seems to me, because from this point on, it is speculation based on my, I must admit, limited experiences, because I cannot transport myself. I don't know teleportation. I have read the technique. It's actually a cool technique. It would require, I suppose, years of practice to actually succeed at that technique. I mean, what you really have to do... Let's start at something easier first. The technique for flying is a lot easier than the technique for teleportation. Because teleportation means basically you just simply transfer all of your cells or all the atoms in your whole body to another spot in the same order they were in. Because if you mess up the order on the way, you're going to have all kinds of weird Picasso-type faces and things like that. So that's a really tough one. But a simpler one is flying, for instance. And of course, everybody's laughing naturally. I mean, flying, simpler. Well, relatively speaking, it's simpler. And what's simpler about it is because it's based on a visualization. And just in case I forget where I'm going with this, I'm going to tell you where I'm going. That this fact of visualization is also essentially a part of flying saucer technology. This is a wild lecture, sorry. And it is also a part of spiritual practice. It's all directly related. And that once you open the door a little bit and have an experience of consciously using this energy, then you've got it. It's captured by you, and you can move with it in other ways if you want, if you're not lazy. Okay, so back to the flying business. The visualization technique for flying, it's openly displayed, is that for one who has the capacity of mystic meditation. This is the prerequisite, because everything is based on the capacity of mystic meditation. I have been for years teaching this technique from all different directions, because unless you catch it, unless you touch it, unless it becomes part of your experience, the door opens. The aha goes aha. The light bulbs go bing. Unless you get that, basically you're dealing in the world of theory. Even if all the philosophy is well understood of various traditions and you can quote it and you can repeat it, but unless you've tasted it in the reality of grabbing it in a consciously reproducible, on-demand capacity, you haven't gotten the key to the mystical meditative process. And it is this key which is the key to all spirituality. Don't let me forget that point, because you know my problem is I wander everywhere, and even though I'm trying to give a consistently organized lecture, I get kind of like, you know, inspired by something and I move in that direction, and then all of a sudden I look at the time and I've been talking for an hour and I got to stop. But the basic fundamental mystic meditative capacity. This is where, as we've tried to describe in all of these meditations and all of these lectures, this is where your consciousness consciously separates itself from that which is irrelevant and focuses itself on a specific task. That is without any motion or movement of the body and without any interaction of the mind. Because as soon as the mind interacts, you have been taken away from the focus and your capacity has been seriously handicapped or crippled. So the methodology is that the mind is not used. Now, I know some people have said there's no way that you cannot use the mind. The mind will always be present. And that you should therefore fill the mind with all of these other ideas, spiritual ideas or thoughts or sounds or statements or activities or whatever. And that way you control the mind. But the mystical energy, the process, requires that the mind is not a functioning element or ingredient during these activities. Now, you can understand that if you understand the mind is a pathway. The mind is a pathway through which the rational connects internally with everything that is internal to us, our energies, our desires, or it's the way in which the physical brain relates between the energy of the living being and the physical body and all of the perceptions from outside. So logically speaking, if you place yourself in a state where that function is not required, it doesn't fulfill any desire in the action, the mind atrophies momentarily. It's no longer required. Because, consider the mystic meditative state, the being is the predominant energy. Your own personal being and the being, the personal being of others within the context of the divine being, the divine energy. That my being reaches out to and connects to directly the being of the divine, the supreme, whatever words you want to use, to the deity, to other spiritual beings. In that state, the body is non-existence. When you come to that state of the essence of your energy, the body is non-existent to you. It ceases to be part of the equation of consciousness. Anyone who is capable of experiencing being in this way, and all of the ones who listen to this broadcast and have been listening to this broadcast for years, have that capacity. Whether you want to publicly proclaim it or not, I don't care. Because this lecture, we can't be humble about it. You can't take this artificial humble position, because to grow, you have to grow on the known, on the skill, and develop it. So can the humility for a second. You've got that capacity. You experience that being. You experience that essence. So in that mystic state, and it is the primary mystic state, let's go to the end and come backwards for a second. In all of the yogic sutras, Patanjali, or you will find also in when Krishna describes yoga in Bhagavad Gita, or in any advanced yogic treatises. The final destination of any yogi is that state I just described. So, humility aside, when you are in this mystical meditative state connected to your being, and you embrace the deity, let's say we're in St. Petersburg and we are embracing our deities there, and our consciousness connects, we become this us. Again, that one of us, this unity of the us, the two become an us. And because they are directly connected in that way, we say one of us, because it's such a unity, the us. That's not impersonalism. That's this height, the peak, the pinnacle of personalism, to attain this us. And this connection is there. That is the goal of yoga. All yoga. You're at the end of the whole thing. So naturally, to go back and understand the processes of mystical activities and everything should be easier because, you know, if you've got $1 million, so to speak, you can give somebody a thousand or 100,000. In reality, it's not so because we can't teleport ourselves. We can't fly. But that's because we haven't developed that because we don't want to. Let's give an example. And not that you don't want to. Everybody wants to fly. Everybody wants to teleport. It's just that we haven't committed ourselves to the incredible amount of time required to do it. But we have examples of that right here. Like, you know, I play guitar. Everybody knows that. Now, I don't play very well. And the reason I don't play very well is that I don't sit myself in front of some absolutely incredible teacher and just surrender to whatever that person tells me to do and just practice and practice and practice until that education becomes so second nature to me, I don't have to think about it. It exists in my fingers. And why don't I do that? First of all, because I'm old and lazy. Probably more significantly, I do all kinds of things. And I do these all kinds of things all the time. So to take out, to commit, I know what it means to learn an instrument. When I was young, I had this classical piano training up until like a certain point when the scores presented to me were pure black and I freaked out. It was too much for me. You know, I was 12 years old and here I am with these totally black scores in front of me and I'm like, whoa, if I'm going to conquer that, I have to give up sports. And I didn't want to give up sports. I mean, I was big time into sports. I didn't want to give up surfing. I didn't want to give up reading. I used to read like mad. I mean, I didn't want to give these things up. These things were as important to me as music. I never said that's the most important thing in my life. One of my characteristics personally is I've never surrendered to one thing over anything else. I tend to do all things at once. That's just my nature. Everybody's different. So if I were to perfect a particular skill, let's say in music, it would require, first of all, a total, really absolute commitment on my part to do so. And I would have to have a reason to do so. I never saw a reason to become, you know, a concert pianist. Actually, I would have rather been a professional baseball player until I got injured, another story. So it's a question of your desire to commit. I didn't have that desire to commit. When you, I can tell you frankly, because I feel the exact same way, when somebody tells us, you can learn how to fly, we go, oh, cool. Is it quick? No, you've got to actually spend perhaps lifetimes doing it. Nah, no thanks. You know, I got my family, I got my friends, I got the things I do. I don't have time for that jazz. Yet, people like the Nagababas, it's not they learned it all in this lifetime. Don't be ridiculous. These are people who have dedicated themselves lifetime after lifetime to the pursuit of incredibly advanced mystic yogic power. It's what they wanted to do. And they worked at it, and they worked at it, and they worked at it until they got it. And then they perfected it. Now, I'm not going to ever say, but, you know, we who have the supreme, we are so superior, because that's absurd. It's actually insulting to humanity to say such a thing. Even though I suggested that you take away humility for a second in this discussion, the removal of humility from a discussion does not mean the entrance of superiority or elitism. That's absurd. To take yourself and declare yourself superior because is a crime against divinity. It is not the divine consciousness. It is not spiritual. Because everyone should understand who has any embracing of spirit that there's only one of us. We are sharing together this divine energy. Our energies spiritually are mixing all the time. We are touching, connecting and touching all the time. That's why synchronicity exists. That's why there's these connections all over the universe. That's why the universe works with us, or we can work against everything by just placing our consciousness that way, because we are all connected. So this conception of superiority, of elitism, is a disgraceful mentality. It shows a lack of real connection. So these, let's say flying. Flying is a technique by which you enter into the mystical consciousness. The mind is no longer a factor. You are beyond the body. You are connected with being. You are being. And as being, you visualize that your physical vehicle, that your energy enters into in every single cell. For your body is you. Okay, you may not be your body, but your body is you. The idea that your body is not you is absurd. It's a rationalization used by spiritualists who are weak, who declare the body to be separate from them. So the responsibility of accepting the sensuality or the desire or the weaknesses of the body may be placed in matter. In reality, the body is you, because your energy is the animating force of the body. Without the animating force, the body is lifeless. With the animating force, the body has any kind of value. Without it, there's no value. With the animating force, it has whatever value, any kind of value that we wish it to have or that it has. So the body is, in fact, animated. It is conscious. It exists because of me. I made it grow. My consciousness is in this thing. Jasmuheen was just there in Moscow, and Everybody who comes in contact with her realizes you don't need to eat. You can just eat prana. I am love. You absorb the prana. And I love. You place the prana in all of the cells of your body. Directly, you are sustaining the body without even any external needs. The body is you. You own that. You accept that responsibility. This is absolutely required in this mystic process. It's kind of a secret to most people. Besides, I'm making it very obvious. If you don't get the point, you don't want to get the point, so don't even bother trying to. So you enter into this, pardon my heaviness there, you enter into this mystical state of being, consciousness. And again, you visualize your body is lighter than a feather. Now that's directly the same thing as like what Jasmine does with this. You visualize prana feeding you and that your body is enlivened by the prana. So when you visualize it, you are drawing it to you. So similarly, you are changing the frequency of the cells of the body because now they are vibrating in a density level which relates to the denser matter scale. It's a frequency which is of the denser matter. So now you change the frequency of the vibration, the living vibration of your cells. You change them to the frequency of something that is light, like a feather. You change them to the frequency of light like air by conscious meditative practice. You change all the frequencies of all the cells to be light like air. And when you actually succeed to do that in all the cells, you float. And when you catch that experience, when you catch it even for a moment, you've got the key, the door opens. The way in which you have the capacity to directly influence matter, quote unquote matter. I never use that word because it doesn't exist. Not that the word doesn't exist, but the concept that it supposedly refers to doesn't exist in that way. Just like this physicist doesn't like to use the word black hole. Because he says it's not a black hole. So similarly, this is not matter. It's just spirit vibrating in a different density level, a different density dimension. So to fly, you transform the frequency of your cells to light like air, and you float. It's a conscious practice. And there's no need for mind because you're not dealing on that dimensional level where mind has any value anymore. It's not that you have to control your mind or you have to separate your mind. It's just naturally the way in which it works. Then to teleport yourself. It's basically, from now on, once you've got that, all of these mystic practices are very much the same on the basic fundamental procedure. The teleportation is you transport all those cells in their frequency from having a coordinate of here to a coordinate over there. Because in this etheric vibration, place is not significant. Time, place, that includes distance, is not significant. There's an instantaneous connection, for example, between people. regardless of the distance between them. That energy is not dependent on distance. So place is not a significant factor. It's not a factor in the mystical energetic realm. Or let's put it another way. In dark matter, place is not significant. Time is not significant. The significant factor is the consciousness. We're going to get to flying saucers in a second. I'm really sorry. This is a wild lecture. It was a wild night last night. And anyway, I'm having a lot of fun. And anyway, I can see those people who don't get it. They've left anyway. So, and that's good. What I like about this stuff is that if you're not qualified, stupid word. If you're not interested in it, you go away. You say, that guy's crazy, can't handle it, goodbye. And that's great. That's the way it should be. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, I know, but before flying saucers. Dimensionality, time. So, in dark matter, there's place is not a factor. So, consider that in teleportation. The interface or the dimensional connection between the manifested realm and the dark matter realm is the consciousness. So my consciousness is now connected to this place, the coordinates, the physical coordinates of this place where I am now. For me, it's significant that I'm here. And it's now, time-wise. Because that is the way in which my consciousness relates. I like to do this because I can, for example, reach for my glass of water because it's physically standing next to me. So I pick it up and drink it because I like to drink water. So there's something in it for me to relate to the coordinate of where I am. But in dark matter, that's not required. Because first of all, you don't need water. Second of all, there's no time. It's timeless, it's placeless. Now, if you can interface with your consciousness these two things, using the power of a timeless, placeless energy, you can shift yourself in time and space to another place by that form of meditation, where the coordinate of your location is now the changed factor. Now, all of this is cool, but once I had a book, maybe I still do, or maybe I gave it to Kamala Mala, I don't remember, about Vimanas. It was a book about flying vehicles from, I don't know, thousands of years ago, maybe not, maybe hundreds, who knows. It's one of those unknown author Indian literatures in Sanskrit. So in this book, one of the main factors of propulsion of a flying saucer is a sun crystal, it's called. And the thing about the sun crystal is that there was no proper name for it in English. The crystal, what it is it's something which absorbs the energy of the sun or other universal energies. It's an absorbing crystal. Its nature is to absorb. Actually, a lot of crystals have that nature. That's why you use tourmaline, black tourmaline, for instance, to absorb bad energies. Or I have here always a rose quartz, which I keep by my computer because it's kind of good for that jazz. And, you know, crystals have absorbing energies. Now, this sun crystal absorbs that kind of power. It's a special crystal which absorbs that kind of power, which has great force. And it is the central propulsion energy battery, so to speak, of the flying saucer. Yet the pilot in this literature is the most important ingredient. The consciousness of the pilot, the diet of the pilot, the dress of the pilot, the activity of the pilot, the preparation for the pilot. And this book was, you know, not really describing totally the connection. But we were talking last night about some people's experiences who had been quote-unquote abducted or whatever. Yet, it seems that in their visions of what happened, there was a crystal in the bottom of the ship, and there were persons with their consciousness sitting around the crystal, meditating in their consciousness on certain substances which covered the crystal, which extracted from it the energy which the crystal stored by the energy of their consciousness caused this interaction to take place. In other words, they were sitting there visualizing in their meditative state, causing this reaction to take place. And then these vehicles would manifest with motion or movement or even in other places. So it seems as if these vehicles are physical manifestations of the exact same mystic yogic process of teleportation. Yeah, anyway, already talking for an hour and 7 minutes. Oh, poor you people. Fun comments from the listeners out there. It's an interesting kind of experience to see the relationship of this mystical and the physical. And again, you know, I was talking about it as not that significant for those who are into the connection to the divine. Yes, there are certain aspects about such connections which are amplified by capacities to relate with matter. I mean, after all, you can have, thank you all for your nice comments, you can have increased spiritual experiences when there is that. I think that it relates to the way in which we value our energy, we value our bodies, we value the locations we are in, we value the life we have. Even knowing you have this capacity, I think, will cause, in fact, that your value of where you are and what you're doing will increase when you know you have other capacities, because you will taste your own personal reality more. And tasting that own personal reality is just as important as experiencing more spectacular things in life. There's been a lot of chatting going on, as you might have seen if you watched. It's very interesting how there's different natures of these comments or feedbacks about what I've been talking about. And I find that interesting because really it relates a lot to the differences between people and what it is that people wish to understand. I find it fascinating the way people respond to the agitation I've kind of like created in their consciousness. Some people, they say, wow, that was really cool. That was really interesting. That was a lot of fun. Other people say, you know, well, I have problems with this like that, or I have problems with this like this. And so it's kind of interesting because naturally you want people to accept what you say. Yet at the same time, what happens in reality is that you will find that not everybody can please everybody. Not everybody is compatible with everybody. It's not that you will find that we have to agree on things, or even that we find some kind of happiness in our communications. There are sometimes we have people or friends who we just like to be with or do things together with, but we may not particularly like to deal with them on this kind of a level of discussion, because it may be that we're striking nerves which people find to be too challenging. And we should respect that when that happens and kind of like, you know, accept the fact that life is complex. And I think one of the more interesting aspects of these discussions is that the complexity of the personalities. Each of us has a particular way in which we wish to embrace these kind of subjects. And we are quite convinced that this is the way to do it. I know that my way of seeing things is not a very common, it's not very common in the sense that it's rather unique to my own rather little revolutionary way of seeing life. Like sometimes I don't mind putting a pin in a bubble. I don't mind challenging traditions. I don't mind stepping into areas which are normally speaking not stepped into. I also don't mind not following the norms of other people's expectations. Yet at the same time, I try to maintain naturally a proper etiquette of dealing, a respectful exchange and communication, especially a respectful exchange of communication. Because it's important to me that, well, actually the most important thing for me is our relationships in this world. For me, although I've stated this before, considering the exchanges that many, multiple exchanges that have been going on in chat format, for me, the fundamental, or shall we say the foundation of my existence is my relationship to the divine beings that I worship as my deities. Worship not in the sense of the usual term, but rather I surrender myself to, I accept as the ultimate foundation of my entire life. And my active participation with, as this us we are, in my activities. That being stated, it's the next priority down is the relationship I have with people. And I very much value that. I value people as people. I value them as the beings they are. I value the connection with them. I value it because this exchange of that spiritual energy, the exchange of that beauty that we are as people, and I mean spiritual beings, okay, but as people, that beauty that we are as people, that seems to me to be very, very important. If you remember that discussion where I talked about our primary duties, our primary service as being there for others, as being a force of good and transformation, of peace and helpfulness and satisfaction. So I find it to be very, very fascinating to me, this service, this primary service. So sometimes this very personal responsibility that is concentrated in an individual, concentrated in myself, let's be personal, that this personal concentrated responsibility, my personal concentrated connection with the divine and my personal concentrated primary responsibility to be of service, has so dominated my life because I have practical realization that this is a magnificent way to not only attain a connection to the Supreme, but it's a magnificent way to maintain it, to nourish it, and to cause it to evolve. But it also does a fabulous job of being of service in this world. So I'm quite happy with that, and I see that this works and people like it. I've been invited into many very deep and confidential circles. I've always declined. I have come in contact with people who have all kinds of great masters and great realizations. I've heard some of them. And honestly, as much as I appreciate it and embrace the not only the motivations of such masters or of the persons who listen, not only of the wonderful spirit that they are and the wonderful support they give people, I embrace that and respect that. Outside of that feeling of the embrace and connection, I haven't found anything that, how to put this, assists me to move forward. And that same embrace and connection I get from my own connections to the divine beings that I connect to, I'm very happy with that. So I'm not as inclined as other people. Now, I know other people, they say, well, you get so much and there's this and that. And I agree with them. And I say, it's great. I agree. 100% I agree. It doesn't relate to me for a pile of reasons. It's okay. I read it. I say, fine. I've heard that before. I understand it. My particular personal discipline takes me in another way because of the nature of what I am as a person. And I embrace that unique self that I am. I'm also a bit of a kaleidoscope. Not so many people understand this, but I have different aspects that shift into different ways of being. And again, there is this continuous problem of my external manifestation and what I am internally. People haven't really got their heads wrapped around it. I think it has to do with the fact that sun sign Scorpios with Aquarius rising are generally a bit more complex than people realize. But I think this point is valuable, number one, so that you understand me better, because after all, here I am blabbing in front of you. And also from the point of view of each of us, if we need to hear this and if we need to have it, not only have a right to embrace our individuality, but it is something that can extremely help us. It's something which can really bring you to some fantastic spiritual connection, some fantastic spiritual experiences. Not only spiritual experiences, but every day, moment by moment, connection with things which are very interesting in the real world. And I think this is a very valuable thing. And I've seen that over these years, my audience has changed and transformed as people actually started clicking with what this particular message is. And it's not that like I've gotten some message from somewhere and I'm a vehicle of the message. Not at all. It's what I am, what I am expressing as a spiritual being or the essence that I am. And it is my expression manifesting through my experiences, which I am sharing. There's a big difference between that kind of sharing and receiving or channeling experience, channeling knowledge or ideas, or entering into a group of some kind, be it a circle of some kind or another or whatever, and representing. I don't represent. I am. And I express what I am. No, I don't represent anything. I spent many years representing. And I think I was a pretty good representative. I put aside my personal understanding. I put aside even my desires on all kinds of levels for the sake of being a very representative personality, to make sure, to guarantee, to protect the interests of those, I use the plural, I represent. And as you all know who know me, this created personal disaster. Disaster in the sense that I lost myself. I see that in Michael Jackson's case. We were listening on the radio, driving somewhere the day he died, and somebody was doing an interview with kids who had been influenced by Michael Jackson, and they were all expressing it. And one girl said something which totally blew me away. She said his main problem was his incredible fame and his so many millions of people who adored him, is that it caused him to cease his personhood. He had to cancel, or it negated his personhood. He had to cede himself from personhood. And I said, oh my God, that's such a fabulous way to put it. He has surrendered himself to this new thing now. He is the star, they are the fans, and he has to live his life as a star with fans now. So this caused him to cede, to give up basically his personhood. And I thought that was cool. That's like kind of like giving up your citizenship of a country, or giving up something that is so integral or integrated within your existence. And I realized this was something I had to do for all those years of being a really good representative. I had to cede my personhood. And when I stuck my foot down and said, no, I'm taking back my personhood, I'm embracing my individual self, I'm going to explore that as well, I'm going to be me, and I'm going to have my own connection to the Supreme, and I'm going to move ahead with personal responsibility, well, immediately, the majority of people who were so impressed with me as a representative rejected me. They said, you are no longer a representative. I am no longer interested in you. And I said, actually, that's great, because it is people like you who don't see me who are the cause of my accepting to cede my personhood. So the fact that you are no longer there is very beneficial for me. So as time went on, other people joined together with quote-unquote me, whatever that means. None of us really understand what that means, so I can say it with humor. They thought, this guy's a rebel, and I don't like ISKCON, and I don't like this and that, so I'll stick with him because we'll do some rebellion kind of things. People approached me. They wanted me to write articles. I was approached by various personalities. They wanted me to reveal whatever. I said, no, thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you. It's not in my interest as a person to work against anyone. It doesn't work for me. I don't like it. It's not what I care about to work against. I don't define myself being negative or against other persons. And so those people also got bored. And they went away to find some other way to make rebellion. I am a rebel against restrictive philosophical conceptions, 100%. I am a rebel against traditions, wherever they may come from and whatever they may be, that restrict me. Yes, no doubt. So then I started really focusing on the individuality and the individual connection with the Supreme and the individuality of my own personal development to reach through what I am. And other people find it, not everybody, but other people find it interesting to also embrace themselves as an individual and to move forward in that way, to move towards the Supreme, the Divine, to make the connection and then move back into the world and connect in the moments they are living in, and then move forward again to connect with the Divine. And I have understood that this is my group. Not that it's my group in the sense it's I'm the leader, you're the follower, because that's totally contradictory to the entire premise that I'm talking about. But it's the people I like to be with. It's the people I like to hang out with. It's the people who I like to talk with. Okay, I'm doing this broadcast. No doubt I got the technology. I figured it out. I'm doing it. You listen. That makes this situation where I speak, you listen. It's not really what I want to do. What I really wanted to do from the very beginning, and those of you who've been there know it, I want to create this all of us together discussing. I could do this if I spent $5,000 a year to make a flash conference with maybe eight people who are in a round table like discussing, and others can observe it. You have to have a flash server license to do that, and that costs $5,000 a year. Then we would have direct interactivity constantly. Now, I haven't really come to the conclusion that I should spend that because I don't have it to spend. And besides, I'm not even sure if that's the best thing. So when I come personally, I like to hang out. When I go to Russia, I hang out, we talk, and we have fun. For me, the most fun I have in my whole life is to go to the park in St. Petersburg and walk around and talk with a bunch of my buddies. I mean, for me, that's really cool. I love it. I would love to do that in general. Hang out and talk. I mean, I just love it. You know, it's great. So, you know, there's all... what I get, like, people send to me, like, these messages that, why don't we structure it like this? Or why don't we work with it like that? Or why don't you join like this group? Then you'd really learn something. And I'm like, gee, my personal way of dealing is I don't try to tell you what to do. I've always said from the very beginning, you listen. If you like it, you like it. You don't like it, don't listen. Unfortunately, due to this medium that we have, me talking, you listening, I'm stuck. I got to express like this. It's not like I'm lamenting about it, but it's what is. I have to express like this. So naturally, if you're listening, you may say, geez, man, I don't want to listen to this. 100% fine. Don't do it. I'm now trying to respond to the various things that people have said to me. And The thing being, when we're personally sitting together, I love to expand what you think. I love to expand the way you think it. I want to know it deeply. I ask a lot of questions. Whenever I'm together with my buddies, I'm constantly drilling them with questions like, why do you think the way you think? What is the reason for that? I don't understand it. Explain it better. It's just, for me, like huge fun. I mean, not that I'm making fun. It's just, I love it. It's an exchange that I really love. So honestly, I will never join a group. It's not a vow. It's not like I'm putting a sign up here. I'll never join a group. I won't even join an etheric group. I won't attempt to join an etheric group. I won't join a physical group. I won't join a group that has a philosophy, because I think what I think. Not that I can't learn. I love to learn. But, you know, it's hard for me to find something that really teaches me. Maybe I'm a lousy student. Or maybe I'm waiting for something which really touches me as a human being. Like I told you, some of you, this, I forgot the name now, but this Clea Danan has written a book about the consciousness, the songs of the earth or something like that, voices of the earth. Yeah. And this lady so spoke to me. It was just like, my God, it was if, because she was interested in the earth and the plants. I love plants. I love the earth. I love this realm. I love to communicate with plants, connect with plants. It's just such a wonderful thing. And that spoke to me. Now, I know I just gave a whole lecture about all this like mystical jazz. Personally, I don't care about it, personally. It was just a really interesting exchange last night, because there were all these professors in this room, everybody talking about really wild, far-out stuff. And I was talking with this guy about dark matter. We talked about vimanas. We talked about mystical things. It was all related to astrology, by the way, because this guy's one of the top harmonic astrologers. Well, he's probably the best harmonic astrologer in the world. And we were talking about things which related to the way in which the planets and the chart will relate, because if you think about it, there's a latency between the actual positions of planets at the moment you're born and the observable positions, because it takes a long time for light to reach the Earth. Like, for example, the sun is very close, relatively speaking. The sun to the Earth is about so far in a big room, and Pluto is way on the other side of the street. And so the latency of time between these emanations reaching us and the observed position of the planets is enormous. So we were talking about that dark matter and the influence of the planets, instantaneous influence through the dark matter. And then I thought about all these things. It's not that I'm trying to teach you the mystic yogic process. Obviously, it's absurd. You need to find a teacher and you need to do that thing. And those of you who are interested in it, you've already done that. It's what I've been trying to do is, I tried to before we got cut off, get to the point of showing you how this is so incredibly important for expanding your individual embrace of what you are and your spiritual energy, and accepting that and working with it, if you want, in these different ways. I'm not into it. Can you imagine flying? Just think about it practically. So if you can fly, let's say you can do a Superman thing, then your whole life would go berserk because people would be after you for flying. Just like in Heroes, that guy, he flies and he gets in big trouble because he flies. If you have these powers, people get on your case. That's why the Nagababas live in the Himalayas, because nobody can go up there to visit them. Teleportation? Yeah, that's kind of cool. Except you can only teleport naked. I mean, that's just, you know, those of you who ever watched a Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator movie know that Terminators come naked because it just doesn't work with clothes. They don't teleport because you can't consciously change the cells of the clothes. So, okay, so I teleport to St. Petersburg and I miss. And I end up in the temple room. Oh, Lord. Or on the street in front. I'm not, you know, ready for that. Sorry. But anyway, even it would be cool. I hate airplanes. But I don't think in this lifetime I'm going to make it teleportation. Very few people do. I don't care what masters you got. Maybe in the future someone may say, here's a cup of teleportation, have it. I'm just too lazy. But anyway, besides all of this, I just wanted to say that I really will continue to embrace me as a person. And I think that's valuable for others because I spent a long time ceasing my personhood. And I was very unhappy with that. And ultimately, it was disastrous, not only for me, but for many others. And I don't think I want to repeat that. So anyway, you know, that's it. I just thought I'd say that. And whether or not that was interesting to all of you guys, I don't know. I just thought I'd share it. I get a lot of messages popping up here, and some say, yeah, great, thank you. And others say, what the hell are you talking about? And, you know, a bunch of different comments. I think it's cool to just be able to express like this, and I hope that you like it too.